We live in a day when some people like to be involved in what is called extreme sports. And in these sports, they do more and more dangerous things, so they get a certain thing called adrenaline rush. It's a tremendous surge of adrenaline because they're in danger, and then they have the strength or the agility to escape. But you can imagine what happens as they develop more skill, more strength, more agility, then the old things that gave them adrenaline rush are no good anymore. They're too easy. So they've got to try something a little harder. And then they get that rush again. And then it's something a little harder and a little harder. It's very addictive. And people think, oh, I can take this risk and get by. And they find out that suddenly one day the margin is too small, or they misjudged it by a little bit, and they meet disaster. You know, it is very addictive to think that you can sin a little bit and get by. I mean, this is just a small thing. I'll just indulge a little bit, and it won't matter so much. What I want us to see today is what I call the legacy of sin. In Genesis chapter 3, we have the account of how sin entered the world. And many people would look at that account and they would say to themselves, well, yes, but it was just a little thing. I mean, there was nothing wrong with eating fruit. God had said you could eat of all the fruit of the trees of the garden, except this one tree, you shall not eat of it, lest you die. And so they just did that one thing. Was that really so bad? We know from reading Genesis 3 that it was very bad. It plunged the world into disaster. It resulted in their leaving the beautiful Garden of Eden. All kinds of things happened. But then Genesis 4 and Genesis 5 help us see how this indulgence that they took actually had far-reaching effects, much deeper, much broader, much more devastating than they could have realized at the time. Sin reaches much farther than expected. Genesis chapter 4 says, "Now Adam knew Eve his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord." You might say this is a statement of faith, in the sense that she is connecting what she has done, what she's experienced, with the Lord. And it seems that she had high hopes for this son, never dreaming the terrible disappointment that he would be. It says, "Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." Notice that Cain was a son who had an honorable occupation. It was actually the occupation that was assigned to Adam in chapter 3. In fact, Abel's occupation, that of keeping sheep, is not mentioned in chapters 2 and 3. And so Cain comes, and he is worshiping the true God. He's not worshiping a false God. He is bringing an offering that cost him something. He was a tiller of the ground, and it's work to produce those things. God had told Adam that it's by the sweat of your brow that you'll have food. And so it's not just that the plants grow and there's the food. It's you've got to dig in the ground and make sure that they aren't crowded out by weeds. And Cain brought of the fruit of the ground. It's a contrast to Abel, who brought the firstlings of the flock and of the fat. And like it says in Hebrews, Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. And so we have a tendency to want to separate the offering from the offerer. And that just will not do. That is impossible. If the heart is bad, even the offering, if properly offered, is not acceptable. And you can see that very clearly in Isaiah chapter 66. In other words, Cain is saying yes to God on Cain's own terms. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. In fact, many people try to do that. They'll say, oh yes, I want to follow God, but they want to follow God on their own terms, which means they're not really following God at all. In fact, that corresponds to Jesus in Revelation chapter 3. You remember he said to the Laodicean church, "You are neither cold nor hot, but lukewarm. I wish you were cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth." The person who's sort of in the middle, he's a person who's following God in a certain sense and yet not truly following God, that produces a complacent kind of situation that is very dangerous. And so God reproved Cain. We don't know how he demonstrated that he was not pleased with that offering, but we know that Cain knew that God did not appreciate that offering, and Cain became very angry. He was blaming God instead of repenting. And notice he ignores God's gracious admonition. Verse 6, "The Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it.'" You see, God's admonition was that sin will rule you. We tend to think that we can rule sin. That's our tendency. Oh, you know, I can indulge in this, or I can do that, and it won't matter too much, and I can control it. But that is not the character of sin. Character of sin is that it will rule you. But notice, even more serious than the sin was his response to reproof. You know, one of the characteristics that you can tell when a person really is on the right track is when sin is pointed out, they want to get rid of the sin instead of harboring it and excusing it. And so Cain refused the reproof. And that set the stage for the next round of evil. And that is active and deliberate malice against another person. You see, the automatic reproof of Abel's life, dedicated to God, was a rebuke to Cain. And Cain wanted to silence that rebuke. It's important to know that Cain was evil before he killed Abel. That's made clear when we glance at 1 John chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. It says, "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous." So Cain was evil before he killed Abel. And if you look down over the account in Genesis, you find a repeated phrase, "brother, brother, his brother, your brother." Again and again, it's emphasizing the enormity of his crime in murdering his own brother. You see, Cain was letting sin rule in his life. And so Cain's sin is much worse than the sin of his parents. Cain's response was worse than Adam's. Regarding his offering, God reproved him and warned him, and he refused that reproof and warning. And he killed his own brother. Now, notice regarding the murder of Abel. God questioned Cain regarding whereabouts. He said, "Where is Abel, your brother?" That is very similar to his question to Adam in chapter 3. You remember? God came into the garden and said, "Where are you?" You see what that's doing? That literary aspect is tying these chapters together. And so it shows that Cain's sin has its antecedent in the sin of his father. And then when God interrogated Cain, Cain had the audacity to lie to God. God said, "Where is your brother?" Cain said, "I don't know." And in fact, you can see that that is a contrast to Adam, who told the truth. And then he had an arrogant evasion of God's question. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Implying that, "God, you have no business asking me this." Another evidence that Cain's sin was much worse than that of Adam is that God cursed Cain. Sometimes people talk about the woman being under the curse. It's not true. God never cursed Eve. He never cursed Adam. He cursed the ground and he cursed the serpent, but he did not curse Adam or Eve. And here you see God actually cursed Cain. And that makes it very clear that Cain's sin is much worse than the sin of Adam. Then the second question, what have you done? That ties back to Genesis 3 again, the very same question that God asked Eve in chapter 3, verse 13. And then, chapter 4, verse 10, the voice of your brother's blood cries out. That ties you right back to Genesis 3, 8. Adam and Eve hear the sound of God coming in the garden. And actually, the Hebrew word can be translated either as sound or voice. It just depends on the context. And so you have the same word used for both places. And Adam has to give account of his actions. So you see, the voice of your brother's blood cries out. And so Cain has to give account. Adam had to give account. Again, you have this tie back. And the source of this cry is the ground. The ground was cursed because of Adam's sin, chapter 3, verse 17. And now the ground is polluted with Abel's blood. You see, there's a literary connection that is emphasizing that what goes on in chapter 4 is hooked into what went on in chapter 3. In other words, it shows that the sin of Cain is connected with the sin of his parents. And notice also, Cain is given the same treatment as Satan. God cursed Satan, and he also cursed Cain. Because Cain has polluted the ground with the blood of Abel, then the ground is especially not going to bring forth its fruit for Cain's sake. Well, how does Cain respond to this? He doesn't repent. He's just afraid of consequences, and he charges God with injustice. He says, my punishment is too great. He's complaining against God. And again, you can see parallels with chapter 3. Chapter 4, verse 14, Cain says, you are driving me. And the same basic word is used in chapter 3 when God drove Adam and Eve out of the garden. Now, God shows his graciousness even to this hardened sinner and gives him a mark of protection. Have you ever wondered, why didn't God mark Abel instead, before he was killed? Instead, he marked the murderer to protect him from being killed by somebody else. And it may be that that was possibly to emphasize that man is not to take vengeance on evildoers. And by the way, that makes Lamech's retribution that he did in chapter 4 even more reprehensible. And it's interesting to notice that after the flood, then you have a shift and God requires man to execute murderers. Well, this relates to something that we see in our day, and that is wheat and tares growing in the same field. Why does God let evil grow? Why does he let the tares grow? I mean, there are Christian cults, and for example, Mormonism. There are churches who deliberately disobey God, and they seem to prosper. Well, that man is a pastor, and he is a blessing to so many people, and he doesn't obey that passage, so why should we? You know, God allows tests of precisely that type, and you can read about it in Deuteronomy 13, 1-5, where someone comes along and says, do this, 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 and it seems like they have a wonderful blessing on their life. Remember, we go by what God says, not what may appear to be blessed. You see, you can choose whether you're going to be a little god of your own. Chapter 4, verse 16, what did Cain do? He departs from the presence of God. It's a very striking picture here. It says, then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. And not only that, he dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. You see, he's self-centered. He's not interested in God impacting his life. And he goes to the land of Nod east of Eden. The implication is Cain is even farther removed from Eden than what Adam was. And he built a city. He built a rallying point apart from God. And so he has success apart from God, just like Adam's sin was gain wisdom on your own terms, apart from God, instead of waiting for God to give you the wisdom and seeking the wisdom from God. And then, Cain founded an ungodly race, illustrated especially by the evil man Lamech. Lamech, if you read on in chapter 4, took two wives, disobeying God's obvious plan. Remember, God created Adam and Eve. It was not Adam and Eve and Sarah. And by the way, it wasn't Adam and Steve either. So we need to keep that all straight. And during hundreds of years of Old Testament history, here in this section of the Bible, there are only four women named out of those hundreds of years. And the two wives that Lamech took are named. And I think the naming of those women is very significant because they were participants in this innovation of the evil practice of polygamy, similar to the other sons who were innovators in things that were good in themselves, namely music and cattle herding and metallurgy. Well, Lamech boasted about being one who killed a man, and he magnified this hurt that he had had and then retaliated to this person. And it's like an arrogant insult to God. Lamech himself is going to avenge more severely than God would Cain. So instead of viewing God's action on Cain as a merciful act to a hateful criminal, he viewed it as a positive precedent where he could make an even greater claim for himself. Now notice, in this thing, God's grace continues to bless sinners. You remember, Jesus said that God gives rain and sunshine to the evil and good, the just and the unjust. And we are supposed to be like that. You might wonder, why does God do this? Well, notice Lamech is especially evil in this line. And what did God do for him? He gave him highly gifted sons who were innovators and inventors. Jabal, innovator with the idea of nomadic cattle herding. Move with the grass. Go where the grass is good. And Jubal invented musical instruments, both stringed instruments and wind instruments. Now just think, if you didn't have any of those, and the innovation of having a string hooked to a board of some kind, a piece of wood, and be able to pluck that string and then hold it down and change the length of it and make tunes, that's a whole innovation. Or construct a pipe and have holes in it so you can hold some of them shut and blow through there and get tunes. Amazing. Not only that, Tubal Cain, the father of metallurgy. Oh, you go out here and you see these rocks and you pound on them somehow and break them to a powder and heat them, and out comes metal that you can form into shapes that is hard and very useful. Those are great innovations. And then he had an outstanding daughter. Her name was Naamah. Doesn't say anything about her. But she's the only woman in that entire history that is mentioned as a daughter. It seems very likely that she was the Miss World of Cain's race, the epitome of whatever they held highest in esteem for a woman. It reminds me of Zeruiah and her sons. Do you remember who Zeruiah was? Well, Zeruiah had two sons, or three, Joab, Asahel, and Abishai. And those guys were tigers, weren't they? And you know, when it talks about those men, sons of Zeruiah, that's a woman. Doesn't even mention her husband. Zeruiah was a sister of David. I mean, she must have been something. Well, here is Naamah. So whatever she was, it was impressive. You see God's generosity in giving outstanding, talented people to this man who is bent on evil. It shows his goodness and generosity even to those who blatantly oppose him. And it also shows that evil people can produce things that are of benefit to society. Those sons of the two wives invented cattle herding, metallurgy, music. You see, God's gracious blessing is absolutely no proof of right standing with God. Now, what we have is that the moral violation of Genesis 3 leaves a terrible legacy that connects to the next generation and the next, producing effects that Adam and Eve would never have anticipated. And those literary connectors between the two chapters help us understand the vital connection of the sin of chapter 3 with the sins of chapter 4. You see, Adam's sin, this small thing, as some people would describe it, of taking this fruit, brought personal devastation. It brought spiritual death, it brought loss of fellowship, it brought banishment from the garden, and it brought drastic changes in how he obtained food. I mean, just think about it. In the garden, you had prepackaged food, ready to eat, you just pluck it off the tree and eat it. And now, he has to hoe weeds. Well, where's the hoe? He had to invent a hoe, or else dig it with his fingers. He has to prepare the soil. And these plants are coming up. Actually, when you think about it, it's quite interesting. Were thistles created in the first 6 days? What's your answer? Well, it says that everything was created in the first 6 days. Everything. That means thistles were good. And they still are good. What are they good for? They are good for healing a gash in the land. All kinds of weeds spring up immediately. When there's an earthquake or a flood and the vegetation gets washed away, what do you need quickly? You need vegetation to spring up quickly. It doesn't have to produce any fruit. It's just to hold the soil in place. And that's what weeds are good for. God created them. They're good. But since man fell, took his own way, then instead of having the prepackaged food that he could pluck really easily, he's got to dig a gash in the land. Well, the weeds are created to solve gashes in the land. So they're just doing their job. Oh, we've got to solve this. Get some vegetation on there quick so that it doesn't wash away. You see, because they didn't live in harmony with God, then they become antagonists to certain aspects of the universe. And so, not only is it hard work to grow these plants, but it is also difficult in terms of a lengthy process for preparing food. It's not just prepackaged, ready to eat. And then, of course, he personally experienced the deterioration of his physical body and eventually died. But what happened in his descendants? In his descendants, there was murder in the immediate family. Cain's departure from God. The founding of this evil line. And then the belligerent violation of God's standard in marriage and in justice. Abel's righteous line had been terminated and evil had a head start. And as you notice, as you read through chapter 4, you find that there's a crescendo of evil. It gets more and more and more. It's not a plateau. It just keeps growing. Adam and Eve were honest with God and they repented when confronted. And Cain was dishonest. He didn't repent. He complained. And Lamech, flagrant disobedience, arrogant boasting about it. Now, what kind of application should we make about this? It is easy to have small violations of God's will in your life and have something that is creating a terrible legacy. You know, it's easy to skip your personal devotions. If you have loss of fellowship that day, and you have loss of insight, and a lack of victory, and a lack of ability to seize the opportunities to minister to others that you otherwise would, you see, that little skip can set the stage for other things. Or what about this? Selfish choices in small things. You know, if you make selfish choices in small things, it will sabotage your life and your family in ways that you have no idea. Or failure to stand for the truth when it is unpleasant. You know, there may be times when you need to stand up and say, wait a minute, brothers, this is not the right way to go, and that is not the politically correct thing to do in that assembly at that moment. You know, if you don't do that at that moment when you should be doing it, you know what your children learn? Your children learn that truth isn't important and it's not worth standing for. What is really worth standing for is the approval of the brethren. And so the second commandment gets elevated above the first. Or the temptation to compromise something small in order to achieve something good. You see, if you say, oh, well, you know what? I know this isn't quite right, but in order to accomplish this wonderful good thing, we're just going to do this. You are walking through a door into another room. And as you walk into that room, there are other doors that open into even grander things if you just compromise another principle a little bit. You know what happens? Your children learn that lesson well. And they start in the compromise rooms that you have brought them up in. And they're in that compromise room, so they're ready to walk through other open doors, even doors into bigger and grander rooms at greater and greater cost that you would be horrified at. Now, what if you've been down that path? You know, Adam and Eve violated God's will, deliberately sinned against what He had commanded them, and then it produced multiple effects, not only in their own lives, but in the next generation. What if you've been there? Is there hope? What if you've sinned as a parent? Is everything lost? I mean, Abel is gone and Cain has departed. What now? Well, we continue on reading in chapter 4. Verse 25. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born. He named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. Notice that this statement, then men began to call on the name of the Lord, happened in the time of Seth's son Enosh. And Enosh means frailty or mortal. It is the opposite of the arrogance of the Cainite line. The broken ones come to God. And notice, what is the significance of this? This is a huge discovery. Men began calling on the name of the Lord. You see, they knew that God was the Creator. They knew that God punished sin. They knew that God required an atonement. But now they discovered something at a whole new level, and that is, God is one who hears when we call. Now you see, this one little phrase, one little sentence at the end of verse 26 describes the essence of the followers of God. They begin to call on the name of the Lord. And that's a contrast to all of these magnificent achievements in the Cainite line. The Cainites, they learned wonderful things about animal husbandry, about culture, arts, music, wonderful stuff, science, metallurgy. They were making huge advances. And what's happening to this other group? Oh, they begin to call on the name of the Lord. God is somebody who hears when we call. That is so much greater and so much more valuable. It is a discovery that is far in excess in its value from what the Cainites had discovered. This one small statement, it makes all the magnificent Cainite achievements look like nothing. It's greater than anything else in the period. And so Enosh, in a sense, is the head of a new race. In fact, the name Adam actually specifically means to designate the husband of Eve, of course. That's the way we usually take it. But it's also a general term for the entire race. But the name Enosh, specifically, it means the son of Seth, but it also means the individual in a general sense or refer to a human race. For example, if you translate literally from Hebrew and you look at Job 5:17a, it says, "Blessed is the Enosh whom God reproves." And if you look at Job 36:25, translating literally from Hebrew, you would read it like this: "All Adam has looked on it, Enosh beholds it from afar." And Psalm 8, verse 4 would be literally, "What is Enosh that you are mindful of him, and the son of Adam that you care for him?" And so Enosh is specifically connected here in this passage with people that begin to call on the name of the Lord. In a sense, he became the head of a new race of men that called upon God and continued on beyond the judgment of the flood. That brings us to chapter 5. In chapter 5, you have a dismal genealogy of doom. Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years and he had sons and daughters. So all the days of Adam lived were 930 years and he died. And it keeps going down through that list, patriarch after patriarch, who had a son, and then after that lived so many years, begat sons and daughters, and died. Over and over and over again. It's a dismal record even for those who are believers. And then there's this sudden shift in terminology. Enoch begat Methuselah. And after he begat Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years. And God took him instead of dying. You see, these other believers lived, did things that were useful, and died. But Enoch walked with God and was taken instead of dying. So what should we learn? Well, there's the broad way. It's being religious on your own terms. It's the way of Cain. We have our own strategy. We have our own plans. We're going to make this thing work. The narrow way is the way of Abel. Abel chooses to do what's right, even if it involves personal ruin. And that's what we must learn to do too. And his testimony continues beyond his death. So what is the outworking of this? Are you doing what the Cainites do at their best? Technology, culture, just being able to get on in this world in a practical way, be able to build a house and make it work? Or are you like Enosh, learning to call on God instead of mere personal development and temporal success? You know, I believe that's one of the things we must be conveying to our children, that the most important thing is learning how to walk with God, like Enoch. Walk with God instead of merely living. You see, the shadow of our life extends far beyond our lifetime. David, you remember, he had a legacy of good. Again and again it would say, so-and-so did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. And the contrast is Jeroboam. So-and-so did what was evil and didn't depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. When you think about it, what will be the main point people remember about your life? Is it going to be something temporal or is it going to be something eternal? So as parents, what should we be learning? We must never suppose that indulgence in what we might think is a small sin won't produce greater damage to ourselves and our descendants than what we can imagine. It's a progression that steadily goes worse and worse. In fact, even the family of Seth eventually was so corrupted that only Noah's family went into the ark. And we need to learn to be like the descendants of Enosh. Call on God for his intervention in our family. Because God can work in our children's hearts. And God has powerful resources to move our children's hearts spiritually. We need to ask God to impress on our children the importance of seeing that a life lived temporally, that's just involved in temporal pursuits that may be good in themselves, and lived apart from God's presence is actually a disaster, an utter disaster. And learning how to call upon God is one of the greatest achievements of life. And so we need to determine that our life will be like Enoch, a walk with God. You see, it's not merely living and having a family. I think that there are many sectors where people almost view that as the most important and primary goal. Let's just have another seminar on the family because we want to get our family straightened out. Well, it's important to get your family straightened out. But if your family is straightened out and you have a nice family that's respectful and all these things are working together well, and it's not really connected to God and his ultimate purposes, it is an absolute disaster. And we've got to get that straight. You see, it's not merely pursuing the legitimate temporal things of life. That's what the Cainites were doing. Now, obviously, as time went on, they were doing lots of wicked things too. But remember when Jesus is speaking about the time of the end in Luke chapter 17, he says, the days of the Son of Man will be like the days of Noah. They were doing what? Eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage. Those are legitimate and right things to be doing on planet Earth. Now, we know from the Genesis account that the people in Noah's day were doing wicked things. Violence filled the earth, yes. But Jesus did not speak of those points. He spoke of the right things they were doing. And it says, as in the days of Lot, men were eating, drinking, buying, selling, building, planting. Are those legitimate things? Yes, they're legitimate things. And interestingly enough, it doesn't say marrying and giving in marriage when it describes the days of Lot. Why? Because they had perverted marriage. So you see, that helps us understand when Jesus is talking about it here, he's saying the people that are left behind when Christ comes for the righteous are going to be the ones who are just pursuing temporal things, not really pursuing things in relation to God. Now, is it good to get married? Yes, if you're marrying in God's will. Is it good to be building and planting? Yes. Buying and selling in the right kind of way? Of course. That's all involved with things that need to be done for life here on this earth. But if that doing of good and legitimate things is apart from God, it is an absolute disaster. And on the great day when Jesus returns, it will be revealed as the absolute disaster. And so we need to determine that our life will be a walk with God like Enoch. It's not merely living and having a wonderful family. It's not merely pursuing the legitimate temporal things of this life. Instead, it's learning to truly walk with God. And I believe one of the things that we need to be learning ourselves as parents and actually teaching our children is that a day not spent walking with God is a disastrous day. And a day spent walking with God is really a great day, even if the temporal aspects of that day are unpleasant or not ones that we would have chosen. May the Lord bless you.